Okay, I hope everyone's caffeinated today and more or less alert. What I'd like to do today, I think, is talk about, finish up a little bit about the mutations that we were talking about last time, because you will be, I finally learned yesterday what you're going to be learning about the rest of this course, and there will be an awful lot of stuff about how to build phylogenetic trees, so you'll learn some of the mechanics of how to do the tree that I showed you yesterday. You'll also be learning quite a bit about the ways in which genes evolve over time. And one of the reasons they do, of course, is because of mutations. And yesterday I tried to tell you a little bit about what we're learning about mutations. There's a lot more to learn about them. It's a very exciting area of evolutionary biology. So we're learning a little bit about it. Some of the consequences of mutations can be quite dramatic, and we'll look at that in a moment. There are other processes, of course, that happen to genes as they evolve over time. One that you'll be hearing a lot about over the next few weeks is genetic drift, random genetic drift, which is, from the mathematical standpoint, it's a fun thing to work with. You can make wonderful equations that follow how random drift changes allele frequencies over time. Random drift probably doesn't have much of an impact on real evolution, simply because random drift had its greatest effect on genes that are essentially equivalent to each other. So if genes are not acted on by selection, they'll be primarily acted on by drift. But certain kinds of random drift can have a huge impact on evolution, because they will determine the result of what happens when populations become broken up into smaller populations. I don't have a picture of this, but there's some wonderful stories about it that I can tell you. For example, in Micronesia, there's a tiny island called Pingalap. And on this island, there are about 1,000 or so people living on the island, the frequency of complete color blindness among the people in this island is startlingly high. It's about 20% of the people living on Pingalap are completely colorblind. They don't see any distinction between colors, they're essentially seeing only black and white. It's tough to be such a person, because you can't stand bright sunlight. Your eyes are so sensitive, because the retina contains only rods rather than, there are no cones in the retina of people who have achromatopsia, which is complete color blindness. So there are no color detecting structures in the retina at all. All you get are light detecting structures. So these people are very sensitive to bright light. They're very good, though, at seeing things in moonlight or even starlight. So it's been suggested, though I think not with that, with no particular evidence, that because people with achromatopsia are terrific spear fishers, they can go out on a canoe at night and see the fish and spear them, you know, with no trouble at all. Maybe this was an advantage. This may explain why the gene is so common on the island of Pingalap. But the real reason is perhaps a little more pedestrian, and has to do with the effect of random sampling, of random drift. It seems that back at the end of the 18th century, there was an enormous storm that swept over the entire island, bringing huge waves with it, and killing almost everyone who lived on the island. There were about 1,000 people living on the island then, of whom about 20 survived. The 20 who survived, it turned out, were virtually all members of the royal family of Pingalap, the king, or whatever the term is, of Pingalap, the chief, I suppose, of Pingalap. And his family survived. And the reason they did, of course, because they were the royal family, they got the best place to hide, okay, and everyone else got swept away. So you're left then with the royal family, who then repopulated the island. The royal family was highly inbred, because royal families do tend to be highly inbred. You know, you don't want to marry an ordinary person, you want to marry another member of the chieftain's family. So essentially the inbreeding, plus the fact that just by chance these people happen to carry the allele for achromatopsia, the variant mutant allele for achromatopsia. These two things combined meant that as the population grew again, it dragged with it, if you like, this accidentally very high frequency of the allele. So there were several things that happened to cause this. The first one was that the population went through a great reduction in numbers, a size bottleneck, so-called. So the population went down from 1,000 to 20. Second thing was, these 20 people were not a random sample from the population. They were the royal family, and just by chance they happened to be inbred, and just by chance they also happened to carry a very high frequency of the allele. If that bottleneck had not happened, then most of the people in Pinkalat would not have achromatopsia. But now 20% of them do. The allele being recessive, there were a lot of other people on Pinkalat who were heterozygous for the allele for achromatopsia too. But everyone followed what happened on this. So essentially, what you find here is a situation in which a chance event, namely the huge storm, coupled with inbreeding of the people who survived, coupled with another chance event, which was the fact that these people just happened to have a very high frequency of the allele, all these things together dramatically changed the very nature of the population in Pinkalat. The population now is very different than it was from the population before the storm. So that kind of impact of chance events on evolution can really be important, because if you have a gene that is disadvantageous, it can actually become quite common in a population just by chance, provided the population is small, provided it's been through some kind of a reduction in numbers. So this kind of interaction then is something that's really quite important. So you've got that going on. That kind of chance process goes on all the time in populations as they split up into subgroups and then blend back together again and so on. These kinds of chance events can have a big impact on processes like speciation, how one species may split into two. If a population is divided into two groups and they live in different environments, and they essentially went through size bottlenecks at the time that they were founded, the groups were founded, then that sort of helps the groups along as they begin to diverge from each other and may in fact accelerate the process of speciation, which is a very important part of evolution. Now, you'll not hear a thing about that, I think, in the rest of this course, okay? I'm just mentioning that this goes on, and it's part, a very, very important part of the whole process of evolution. Something else you may not hear a lot about in the rest of the course has to do with natural selection. People, I think, who work at the theoretical end of evolutionary biology tend to discount or forget about the effects of natural selection. It does sound funny, but in fact it's true. So remember, for the rest of this course, that if somebody goes on and on about drift, and allele frequencies fluctuating by chance and things like that, just stick your hand up and say, hey, what about natural selection? Because people do tend, I think, to forget about the effects of it. The effects of natural selection can be very dramatic indeed. Let me just show you an example of this. What we have here is an orchid flower. It's a rather unusual looking orchid flower for the simple reason that it rather looks as if a bee has landed on the orchid, right? You can see this sort of bee-like structure, which is part of the flower. The entire flower is this whole structure. This bee-like structure is part of the flower, and damned if it doesn't have a couple of what look like wings on either side of it, all flapping away here. The orchid, and this is one of the large number of orchids that have evolved flowers like this. This orchid produces a flower that looks like the female of carpenter bees that live in the same area. Male carpenter bees will see the flower, home in on it, and they are attracted to the flower by sight and also by the fact that the flower secretes a pheromone, that is to say an attractive chemical, which is essentially the same as the attractive chemical secreted by female carpenter bees. Now, and of course the bee then, the male bee arrives, tries frantically to mate with the flower, and in the process picks up pollen from that flower and then transfers pollen to the next flower. This can't be explained by random drift, okay? There has to have been something much more complicated going on here. And I think, as you think about evolution, you have to remember that there are some truly remarkable processes that have resulted, remarkable phenomena that have resulted from the process of evolution that can't be explained by simple mathematical equations that follow allele frequency fluctuating over time. Something much more complex has happened here. There has been a co-evolution of the orchids and the bees. And that co-evolution essentially has resulted in an orchid that looks very much like a bee, and a bee that's particularly attracted to these orchid flowers. Of course, it's attracted to females of the bee species as well. But the point is that these two things have happened simultaneously. This co-evolution has gone on as a result ultimately, of the appearance of mutations in both populations, the fixation of these mutations in both populations, that just have happened by various combinations of these genes to produce flowers that look more and more like the female bee, and bees that are attracted more and more to these particular flowers. That's the ultimate process. The driving force behind all this, of course, is natural selection. The advantage to the bee is that it is essentially... It can get cheated, exactly. Yeah. It can get cheated because if in fact there are an awful lot of flowers of this type, then of course the bee never meets a female bee and it's got a real problem, exactly. The advantage to the bee, it turns out, has to do with the fact that it is capable of discriminating to a greater and greater degree among the flowers to which it has to which it is visiting, and in fact can pick up loads and loads of pollen from these flowers. These flowers are essentially designed in such a way that if the male attempts to copulate with the flower and picks up a lot of pollen of that flower, it can take some of that pollen back to the bee's hive. It turns out, in fact, that bees depend not just on the nectar that they pick up from flowers, but also from the pollen. The pollen is, in fact, a very important food source for the bees. So, essentially, by having a lot of flowers of this type, the bees are assured of getting a substantial load of pollen from the flowers. And that is, essentially, the other reward that the flower offers to the bee, the reward, essentially, that the flower offers to the bee. So that kind of interaction, where essentially you have a two-way benefit, a benefit to the flower because it gets fertilized, a benefit to the bee because it has an assured source of a particular type of food, is something which has led to this remarkable kind of evolution. Okay? Yes? Oh, it's true. The bees are sterile. Okay. It turns out, in fact, though, that these carpenter bees live in rather small colonies, okay? And both males and females forage, so they're a little bit different from... They're a little bit different from your ordinary bees. Now, the bees that forage normally for pollen and nectar that live in very large colonies are primarily sterile, and most of the bees that do the foraging are females. Sorry, it gets more complicated if you get into the natural history of this. But the selection that goes on the bee colony is such that if the behavior of the sterile foragers is such that it increases the likelihood that the queen and the males that the queen produces will survive, then because the sterile bees, the sterile worker bees, share genes with the female and with the males that she produces, then those genes will tend to get passed on to the next generation. It's as if, in a way, you can think of a bee as a kind of a bee colony as a giant organism, if you like. Okay, we have evolved fingernails, all right, to stop our fingers from wearing down as we scrabble for things. The cells of the fingernails, the cells that produce the keratin of the fingernails, essentially are their information doesn't get passed on to the next generation, but the same information is carried by our gonads and does get passed on to the next generation. So in the process of evolving very elaborate structures, if you like, elaborate phenotypic structures, we are essentially doing in a way the same thing that the queen of the beehive is doing, because she has essentially, the beehive has evolved different kinds of specialized females for foraging, females for defending the hive, and so on. So all this essentially is happening as a result of natural selection processes that you can disentangle. There's some rather nice stuff there that I don't really have time to go into, but suffice to say that the even though you may think that the workers are dying without issue, they are nonetheless, their genes are nonetheless being passed on through the queen. It's a process that's called kin selection, where you're essentially selecting on your kin. Mm-hmm. Yes. That came up last night at dinner, and I think it's a common, I think, misconception about the way the natural selection works. The question was that, you know, this seems such an unlikely thing to happen. What's the likelihood that some sort of mutation would happen that would produce a flower like this, okay, right from scratch? Well, the answer, of course, is that it didn't all happen at once. If you had a flower that just by chance produced a bit of a structure on it that looked ever so slightly like a bee, then it might attract more bees than it otherwise would. More bees of that species than it otherwise would. If it produced a pheromone or a scent that was ever so slightly like the pheromone produced by the female bees, then that again would tend to attract. So you've got to think of this thing as being a series of moderately unlikely events. Remember I pointed out yesterday that the sickle cell mutation is happening all the time in populations of humans. Here's a situation in which a mutation which seems to be very unlikely, and we had a look at just sort of how unlikely that was in one of the slides, one of the transparencies that I showed. So here's a very unlikely sort of a situation, but it's not totally unlikely. It's not one in a trillion or something like that, because several of them happen every generation in the human species. The thing about natural selection is that it essentially works on a series of moderately unlikely events, which, when summed together, give you an extremely unlikely outcome. Simply because if you select on something that happens one time in a million, and then that character takes over the population as a result of selection, and then another one time in a million event happens, and that character takes over the population, it isn't very long before you get the chance that that would have happened all at once would be one time in a million times one time in a million, which is you know, getting down towards the very, very small. But if you had a series of one in a million events, then in fact it becomes much more likely. Yes.
What about the development of something like a lump, where it is making to move out of water? If you have that sort of fully developed, it's really important.
It can be, if, like a lungfish, you spend part of your time out of water and part of your time in water. There are three groups of lungfishes. But the question is, what about the evolution of the lung? I don't know if people can hear the questions. Can people?
Yes.
Well, I know of no examples where you do not find somewhere in the natural world some intermediate type. Sometimes there are gaps in our knowledge. Sometimes the organisms that were intermediate have disappeared, you know, they became extinct or something like that. So there are lots of gaps. But in many cases, you can really see a kind of a continuum here of different stages, which... Yes, if in fact you went through a stage where it wasn't preferential for some reason, suppose you were sort of going up and up and then you hit something where the next mutation is not preferential, then something like random drift can play a role, because that less preferential mutation could by chance be fixed in the population, which would then allow you to get to the next preferential one. So you can combine selection with drift and even get through some of these local minima as you move towards a more and more elaborate structure or a better and better adapted organism, something like that. So always, when you think of these things, you have to consider everything all working together. You know, the drift and selection sometimes can do things together that selection alone might not be able to do. You might have to get through some local non-optimum and out the other side. And sometimes chance events will allow you to do that. A better example where there is no obvious advantage until it's fully developed. I know of no such example in the natural world, simply because at the time that these characteristics first evolved, they did so in a world that perhaps didn't have them at all, in a world with no lungs. If you're an organism that is living in a stream, and the stream dries up periodically, it's tremendously to your advantage to have some sort of a structure, in this case an outpocketing of the esophagus, that allows a greater degree of oxygen exchange during the time that you're entombed in the mud of this dried up river, okay? And allowing you then to keep a reasonable amount of metabolism going until the water comes again. Then, of course, if that gets a little bit bigger and more complicated, you can last for longer periods and so on. So there's very, very strong selection for mutations that increase the size and the complexity of this little outpocketing of the esophagus. Such a very small outpocketing of the esophagus has been found in the coelacanth, which is a deep water fish now, although many of them lived in shallower water in the past. You may know the story of the coelacanth. It's a living fossil. It's an organism, the last fossil representatives of which had been found 60 million years ago, 65 million years ago, at the end of the age of dinosaurs. And it would appear they all went extinct. Until in the 1930s, a living coelacanth was found off the coast of East Africa. And other coelacanths have now been found in Indonesia. So now it looks as if there are populations of these fish that still live fairly deep in the ocean, scattered around the Indian Ocean, and I bet we'll find more of them as time goes on. Coelacanths have little pockets on each side of their esophagus. Now, either these are degenerated lungs, you know, back from a time when they almost became land-dwelling organisms, or they may be the beginning of the development of lungs. The striking thing about coelacanths is that they've actually got limb-like structures rather than the ray-like fins of other fish. The coelacanths are remote relatives of our remote ancestors. The coelacanths actually walk around still on the bottom. There's some amazing footage of coelacanths 700 or 800 feet down in the ocean walking around on the bottom with their stubby little fins. Okay? They're remembering the time when they almost made it out of the ocean. And they didn't, and they went back. I'm being anthropomorphic here, but you see what I'm saying. So this common misconception that there are structures and functions and behaviors in the natural world that couldn't have arisen through a series of gradual steps, I think is something that puzzles people about evolution a lot. I think it puzzled you about evolution a lot, and I suspect it puzzled many people in the audience about it. How do you get from one to the next?
I think that many of us have read about this kind of argument that are most popular by the many writers of the doctrine. Have there been really serious estimates of the probability, you know, really how unlikely it is, or is it likely, how many generations of this is unsure, reasonable, or do you get, you know, two orders of magnitude off? I mean, that's the kind of thing that you make the first estimate.
Yes, exactly so. Are there any actual... Well, I think you'll have to ask, rather than asking, you know, what kind of theoretical underpinnings can you have for this, because in fact, if you put enough little steps in, you can get anything, okay? You have to ask what is actually happening in the real world. And what seems to be happening in the real world as we begin to examine the species more and more closely, and as particularly we begin to examine the molecular biology of development, that is to say, the ways in which organisms develop. We're now discovering, I didn't bring any transparencies of this, I should have done, but we're now beginning to discover situations in which you actually have some species that are polymorphic. Within the species, they vary in terms of the organization of their structure, the organization of their bodies. Okay? So that you've actually got substantial differences between different members of the species. And these organizations can sometimes be quite dramatic. There is, for example, a species of lily that was first looked at by Linnaeus, the famous Swedish taxonomist who grouped everything and gave everything a name, right? He invented the genus and the species and essentially he pigeonholed everything, okay, so that all organisms have a genus and a species name and they all belong to families and orders and so on. So Linnaeus put all this stuff together. The lily that I mentioned is one in which some of the flowers in the population are radially symmetrical and other flowers are bilaterally symmetrical. Okay? So within this same species you have two distinct types of flowers. And they've now looked at the single gene that is responsible for this. The genetics is a little messy, but there is in fact a genetic difference between a single genetic difference between a single gene, essentially, that is responsible for this switch. And that's a dramatic switch. We're talking here about something that the geneticist Richard Goldschmidt would have called the hopeful monster in the old days. There is a dramatic change in the organization of the flowers of this species. Now that change has happened as a result of a change in a particular regulatory gene, one that affects this development. So here you've got a case where within a species you've got this kind of situation. There are other situations, for example, in a number of different species of centipede. Centipedes, you know, are relatives of the insects, and they have, as their name implies, something on the order of 100 legs. And some centipedes have more than 100 legs, some have fewer. I don't know of any centipede species that have exactly 100 legs, but in any case, centipedes have lots of legs. And they have lots and lots of little segments, essentially, and there's a pair of legs on each segment. So you've probably seen the nasty things scuttling around here, and you have to watch them, though some of them are quite poisonous. Centipedes, there are some species of centipede in which you find within the population some members of the population that have twice as many segments as other members do. Okay? So we've got a situation here in which within this population there is genetic variability, and you can breed these centipedes and show that they breed true. Nobody knows much about the genetics of centipedes, but it's getting there. Eventually, when you learn how to raise the darn things in the lab more effectively, I think it'll be possible to do more experiments with them. But what you've got, essentially, is heritable variation that can be passed from one generation to the next, that determines the number of segments you've got within that population. So if there were an advantage to having lots of segments, then it doesn't take long for you to select the population that has lots of segments. If you have an advantage for a small number of segments, it won't take long to select for a population that has a small number of segments. And quite obviously, these centipedes live under circumstances where there's some advantage to having lots and other advantages to having small numbers of segments. So this, whatever the selective phenomena are that are maintaining this genetic variation, it's striking to see, once again, that you've got variation that people would have argued, would be so dramatic, so huge in its effects, that it's very unlikely that it could happen as a result of a mutation. But in fact, it does happen as a result of a mutation. Every time you look at the molecular biology of these phenomena, you begin to see something quite interesting happen. Let me just give you some examples of this, which I think might make sense to look at here.
Yeah, I see in the gene that produced twice as many legs. The mutated gene and the original gene, are you able to quantify how different the two genes are? Is it a different gene?
The genetics in centipedes hasn't been done.
Oh,
the
right.
Genetics in the lilies has been done, okay, and they find indeed, a number of changes have happened in the genes and also in other genes that affect those genes. Not many.
No.
The differences are not large. That's right. Just a few. Okay. It's not a big deal. It's not as if you had to invent a whole new gene or something like that. Okay. The ability to switch between radial symmetry and bilateral symmetry is not very great. You don't need a big difference. I'm sorry. Of the gene that codes for a protein, yes.
Mm-hmm. But the protein is changed.
The protein is changed as a result of a mutation in the DNA. Right. There are differences in the DNA that give rise to different proteins that interact with the developmental pathways of the flowers, so that you end up with very, very different flowers at the end.
Can be just mutation overall.
Indeed, exactly so. Yes. It is not as if these two types of flower had thousands of genetic differences between them or something. There are a very small number of differences that can bring about this kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Come back to the question of evolution between the scientists. Can you explain the mutation between the biological flower and how many different flowers between the two flowers and also
Absolutely. Mutations can happen in genes that, let's say, are expressed in some tissues and not in others. Mutations can make genes turn on or turn off at different times during development. It's quite possible, yes. Such a mutation could happen in a gene that hasn't been turned on for a while. If you get too many mutations in such a gene, you can destroy its function. the one very interesting story about this has to do with the development of tooth primordia in birds. We've all heard the expression rare as hen's teeth, right? You know, teeth. Now, hens don't have teeth, everyone knows that. But the ancestors of hens had teeth. And it turns out indeed that the gene that is responsible, one gene which has been tracked down now, that is responsible for the development of little tooth primordia in the jaw of birds has been inactivated in that tissue. Okay? So if you can activate it again, and you can do it by taking a little piece of developing chick embryo and putting it next to a little piece of developing amphibian embryo with the lizard embryo, so that you've now got a piece of lizard embryo next to a piece of chick embryo. Compounds made by this gene diffuse into the chick, and you start getting little teeth growing out in the chick embryo, okay, or the beginnings of teeth at least. So you're bringing back teeth to an organism that hasn't had teeth for something on the order probably of 100 million years. Well, that's quite dramatic. The machinery is still present in the chick. Why should the machinery have lasted so long? Well, it's lasted long because it turns out that machinery is useful for other kinds of development of the chick. In the jaw of the chick, if you can think of it that way, in the developing beak of the chick, these genes are turned off, so you don't get any teeth. In other parts of the chick, the genes are still turned on. Okay, so the genes are still there. It's just that the ability to turn them on in the jaw or the beak of the chick has been suppressed. Now, as I say, that's something I should have brought because that's a fun example of the kind of experimentation that you can do to demonstrate that the machinery for producing a particular kind of developmental outcome, that machinery can still be present for long periods of time if that machinery happens to be useful in some other part of development. So you've turned it off selectively in one part of the chick. Now, does that you see how that can work? And that experiment, as I say, is a lovely experiment, and I think really demonstrates quite clearly that you can maintain stuff if it's useful somewhere else. You know, multicellular organisms are very complicated. You know, some of our genes are turned on in our livers, other genes are turned on in our brains, and so on. The opportunity for manipulating the turning on and turning off of these genes and to do some pretty startling things is, I think, very great. And here's an example. Walter Gehring and his colleagues took a gene in Drosophila called Ilus. If you have a mutant of this gene, the flies either make no eyes or their eyes are very much reduced in size. Okay, so this Ilus mutation essentially has a dramatic effect on the phenotype. But if you take the wild type Ilus gene, that is to say the regular gene the flies regularly have, so it's a little confusing to talk about an Ilus gene, but think of it as the eyed allele of the Ilus gene. Okay, this is the one that gives you the eye. You take that gene and put it on a mobile element, so-called P element, and attach to the beginning of this gene a promoter region that turns the gene on full blast. Okay? And then inject Drosophila embryos with this mobile element so that the element now spreads through the cells of the developing Drosophila embryo, which you can do if you catch the egg early enough. You can get the mobile element in and it'll sort out as the cells begin to partition off inside the embryo. So you can do that. If you do that, now the gene has this eyeless gene, the fly has this eyeless gene turned on in all its cells. And when it does, you can see the effects. You get eyes all over the place. You get eyes here on inappropriate parts of the head. You get eyes here on the legs. You get eyes on the body. You can get eyes all over the place, right? This gene is now making eyes all over the place in inappropriate places. The reason it doesn't do that in the fly in ordinary circumstances is because it's regulated so that it's only turned on in the appropriate segments and only makes eyes in the places where it should. But this one change of this regulatory gene can do some pretty dramatic things. Now, if it happens, for example, that it's advantageous for a fly to be able to see with its elbows, which doesn't seem likely to me, but maybe such a thing could happen, then that single change that turns the gene on in the elbows, would be enough to produce an eye in other places.
Mm-hmm. Are these eyes connected to the brain?
Interestingly enough, some of the eyes on the head actually do build connections to the brain,
but not the ones
in the elbows. No.
It's obviously human
to have an eye back there. Especially if, yes, exactly so.
Evolutionary people have an eye.
But you know, we do have an eye, essentially, in what used to be the back of our head. It's called the pineal gland. The pineal gland is at the base of the brain. The pineal gland is a degenerate eye. That degenerate eye expresses some of the genes that are closely related to this eyeless gene, okay? Further, there are some organisms that do have an eye at the back of their head. The Tuatara lizard of New Zealand, which is a rather close relative of the dinosaurs. It's a very primitive lizard, or at least a different branch of the lizards, and you can trace its history back to the dinosaurs. The Tuatara has a functioning eye on the top of its head, which is very useful, I guess, if you're being preyed on by skua gulls or something like that, and you want to keep an eye, keep a weather eye, as it were, on what's happening to you over at the top of your head. Okay. So, we've done it too. We've made eyes in other places, okay? And there's no reason to suppose that, given that, you know, if you were to do the same experiment on people, you'd perhaps find eyes that turn up in unexpected places as well. So if the eye happens to be, as in the case of these flies, close to the original eyes, it can actually make connections to the optic tectum of the brain of the developing fly. And you can then end up with functioning eyes. Extra-functioning eyes, if you like. I don't suppose they see much with these eyes, but nonetheless, the connections can be made. And you can then go, coming back again to the question of how you get, you know, from one thing to another, it's quite possible, essentially, to see how, through a series of steps of this kind, mutations of fairly large effect, but not overwhelming effect, you could actually get to an organism that's really quite different from the one you started with. And that, I think, is something that people tend to be very puzzled about where evolution is concerned. How can you get from one thing, one species to another very, very different species? How did all this happen? You know, what organization, essentially, genetic events in the population could bring about such changes?
You said that some of the eyes are connected to the brain, but I'm still very, very surprised to hear that you have seen a eye from it. That somehow the brain would also have a neural network that would process that information. Is that some other?
Well, it does. Other genes are present such that as the nerve endings of the eye grow down into the head, they then essentially signal neurons in the head to come out and meet up with. So there's a lot of signaling goes on here. That signaling wouldn't happen if you didn't have this eye, all right? You'd only get signaling from the regular eye. But you get signaling from this eye. That machinery is present in all flies, okay? So that you don't have to mutate the flies to get that signal to happen. The brain is a very flexible thing, as you know. The brain can be stimulated to develop in all sorts of different ways. As you probably know, they've done some rather marvelous studies that I love very much that has to do with the size of the amygdala, which is a little structure in the on the side of the brain which, among other things, processes positional information. London taxi drivers who have to learn their way around the enormously gigantic and complex city of London have enlarged amygdalas. Okay, so all that effort of the taxi driver to learn his or her way around the enormous city of London, they call it the knowledge. Those of you who've ridden with London drivers know they're absolutely amazing. Unlike taxi drivers in New York, they can actually get you somewhere and they know where they're going. So the result then of this learning has actually enlarged their amygdalas. And so the brain is very flexible. The brain of the fly is very flexible. If it gets a signal from a new eye, it'll say, all right, there's a new eye out there, I'll grow out to meet it. And that's exactly what happens here. So there's a huge interaction here then between genes and environment. Always a tremendous amount of interaction between these things as you go along. Yeah? We have a degenerate eye, yes. The eye is called the pineal gland. It's at the base of the brain. That's right. The pineal gland, actually, is what picks up signals. You know, you can actually get a certain amount of light through your skull and your brain down to the pineal gland. So if, for example, you can actually entrain people, so to speak, by shining bright lights on their skulls. And entrain them so that they then, if you briefly shine a bright light, then all their circadian rhythms, all their biological rhythms essentially are entrained to that bright light signal. And they've done experiments in which they've removed the pineal glands of experimental animals and discovered that they've lost this ability to be entrained. The pineal gland isn't just sitting there and not doing anything. It's getting signals from the environment to say, it's noon, you know, or something, or it's midnight, because there's no light or there's a lot of light. It's funny to think about our skulls as being that transparent to light, but of course it doesn't need much, the pineal gland doesn't need much light to be triggered, apparently. So, even though there seems to be a degenerate structure with no obvious function, it in fact has been shown to have some function. And function connected with the perception of light. Not that it's seeing anything, you understand, except that it's seeing that, you know, there's a bright light out there. It's not seeing an image or anything like that. It's certainly lost the capability of doing that. It's just
my
a little... I think that's quite possible. I'm sort of getting that way myself. Yes, right. So, tremendous advantage here. The those of us who are either bald or going bald can feel a little smugly about that. Yes, right. Also, baldness has been suggested as being a signal of male prowess, as you probably know. Yes, right.
Mm. It has the structure of an eye and photoreceptors.
No, no, it has some photopigment in it, but the structure is essentially all pretty well gone. Okay, the pineal gland is really just a little sac with you know, the cells in it that can in fact respond to light signals. That all the there's no need for the pineal gland to see any image or anything like that. And as a result, then mutations that have accumulated that lose these capabilities have not been selected for. And not been selected against, I should say, and they have tended to, over time, degenerate the structure. If things aren't selected for all the time, they do tend to degenerate. We were talking about pseudogenes, you remember, yesterday. Here are genes that have been inserted into the genome, and then they begin to accumulate mutations here and there in the gene which will destroy their function. Pseudogenes essentially have accumulated mutations that are not selected against, and as a consequence they begin to build up in the gene, and after a while any possibility that the gene could ever be functional again is lost. So you always have this kind of thing happening. If you release selective pressure on a gene, then it'll begin to accumulate noise in the form of mutations that would have been harmful if the gene had still been functioning. Okay? So,
The problem with the pineal gland is something that says, evolutionarily it's going out, and it was an eye. Could it also be that perhaps it's something that is evolving?
I'm sure it is. The pineal gland probably has lots of functions we don't know anything about, okay?
But more to the point, is there any evidence for the continuous evolution of pineal?
There is evidence, I don't know anything about any indication that the pineal gland is continuing to evolve in humans. But there are some interesting examples, I think, of what happens when we stop using a sense, or don't use it as much as we used to. Our sense of smell is far less well developed than the sense of smell of many other organisms. If you've ever owned a dog or a cat, you know that they really do home in on smells. They really are very good at this kind of thing, and lots and lots of other animals. Our sense of smell has degenerated partly because the olfactory lobes, which are sort of right in the front of the brain, have become very much smaller relative to the rest of the brain than in other animals. There are many other animals where the olfactory lobes are really big. Some other animals in which they are the predominant sense organ of the brain. Okay? So you have a huge variation in the size of the olfactory lobes. In humans, the olfactory lobes have shrunk. On top of that, it's also recently been discovered, I think fascinating piece of work, that there are genes in our genome, quite a lot of genes in our genome, probably about 100 of them, that code for olfactory receptor proteins. These genes have arisen by a series of gene duplications. So we have 100 very similar genes that code for slightly different olfactory receptor proteins. Okay? Now they've looked at a bunch of these genes in mice, and they're fine. All these genes are fine. They all function, you know, they're all complete. They all do their thing. If you look at the gene, you don't find any nasty termination triplets or anything in the middle of the gene. You heard about termination triplets right earlier on. You don't find things that interrupt the translation of the gene, so you don't get a complete gene product. The mice genes are fine. These genes have been looked at in humans. It turns out that about two-thirds of them are interrupted by mutations that make them non-functional. Two-thirds of them are now pseudogenes. Okay? So two-thirds of our olfactory receptor genes, we've got just as many as mice have, but two-thirds of them have been essentially interrupted by mutations, so they're no longer functional. I expect that varies from person to person. I shouldn't be surprised if, I know, you know, from personal experience, talking to people, that my perception of food, and remember, much of what you what constitutes taste is in fact smell, right? Most of taste is smell. If you can't smell, food doesn't taste it much. You get a cold or something like that, then food is less interesting than if you don't. It must vary tremendously from one person to another, because some people can pick up nuances of flavor. My wife, who is Chinese, is very, very sensitive to the nuances of flavor that I certainly can't perceive. She'll cheerfully sit down and eat a bowl of buttered noodles with enjoyment, something which I don't understand at all. Coming as I do from an English tradition where food, the taste of food is essentially irrelevant, and the only thing the only thing that matters is the calories that you take in, okay? Then, quite obviously, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody did my molecular biology and her molecular biology that you would have more functioning olfactory receptor genes than I do. It could be that there are functional and non-functional alleles in the human population for many of these genes. We don't know anything about that because it's a big job to sequence these genes, and it's only been done in a very limited way. But here's a situation in which two things have happened in our evolution. In one, our olfactory lobes have shrunk. After all, we're upright. We don't get right down onto the environment. We don't smell things all the time, right? We're not sniffing about on the ground the way most organisms are. What we got instead was a general kind of vision, binocular vision. Essentially, the visual fields of our eyes are overlapping so that we can see things in three dimensions. All the primates, including the primitive primates, like the lorises and the tarsiers, all the primates have overlapping visual fields. Very useful if you want to see how far away something is, okay? We also have developed grasping organs in the form of our front feet, our hands, which allow us to reach out and grasp things. I was in the jungles of Borneo a few years ago, and went to an area where there were tarsiers. Tarsiers are very primitive primates, little animals about so big, little long tails, big goggly eyes, and the eyes face forward the way ours do. These animals spend all their time scurrying around in the night, in the rainforest, grabbing crickets. There are lots of crickets that sit on the leaves of the various plants. And as they hop from one plant to another, they can hop very nicely, keeping a big springy back leg. They can reach out and grab these crickets. And you can see that we do the same sort of thing. You know, we have great binocular vision, we can reach out and grab things. They don't need a very sensitive sense of smell to do that. They need a terrific sense of sight. They also, by the by, need very good night vision. Their eyes are very big, and the retinas are full of rods rather than cones. So I don't know what their color vision is like. It's probably not that great. But they're terrific at finding those crickets. Just like those people in Pingalap, right, who are terrific maybe at spear fishing. If you look into this stuff, the whole thing sort of falls into place. You can see why we evolved the way that we did. So there was a trade-off here. Our vision is nowhere near as neat as the vision of some other organisms. Some other organisms have highly adapted vision for doing very specific things. If you're a bird of prey, if you're a hawk or an eagle, your vision is specialized, so there's a very, very sensitive foveal area in the middle of the retina which magnifies a part of the visual field, so that from 3,000 or 4,000 feet in the air they can see a field mouse. And further, this fovea is down in a deep pit in the retina, so they can use the fovea like a bombardier's sight as they zoom down on the field mouse. If the image of the mouse deviates too far from the center of their image field, it becomes very distorted because it hits the edge of this pit. Okay? So you then end up with a situation in which they can literally home in on this field mouse from way up there and go straight towards it without deviating from it. It's a feedback system that they have, of course, evolved. Well, we don't have anything like that because we don't often dive on field mice from several thousand feet in the air. But we do have a pretty good general kind of visual field that has the enormous advantage that it has these overlapping areas. Other animals do too. Of course, owls have a substantial overlap to their visual field, which is very useful because at night they want to see how far away things are, like branches. They don't want to hit branches all the time. They'd like to know, you know, what to avoid. The investigation of sense organs, I think, is a fascinating aspect of evolution because as you see what happens to these sense organs, how they change, how they evolve, you can begin to get an idea of all these intermediate steps that lie between organs, sense organs like ours, and sense organs of mice, or the sense organs of tarsiers, or any number of other organisms. You can begin to fill in the blanks here, fill in the gaps. Yeah. Ah, then they lose their eyes. Okay? And we know exactly why they lose their eyes. It turns out that the eyeless gene has a homologue, that is to say, it has a relative, if you like, in the fish, just as it does in humans. And that homologue becomes mutated in the caveless fish. So it no longer now makes the eye. Okay? So the eyeless gene of Drosophila, the mutation was first found in a laboratory population of Drosophila. It happened, you know, just by chance. In the case of the cave fish called a Styanax that lives in the southwestern U.S. and down into Mexico, a Styanax lives normally in little streams. But there have been at least 10 or 12 different introductions of a Styanax to different cave systems in this whole area. Each time, they've lost their eyes. And each time, as a result of independent mutations in this eyeless gene. So you've got a wonderful example of how a single mutation can bring about a very dramatic effect. Now, the shrinkage of the eye is accompanied by other mutations too that increase the amount of tissue growing over the eye and so on. You might ask, well, why did this happen? You know, why did they lose their eyes? Why didn't they just keep them? Because after all, is there any, you know, particular disadvantage to having an eye in a cave environment? The answer seems to be, yes, there is a disadvantage because the eye is an avenue of infection in the cave environment. If these fish live in caves, they are very susceptible to infection by Saprolegnales fungi, which are very common in the caves. And so the fish, you probably had this happen to you if you've ever had an aquarium. The fish suddenly gets a sort of fuzzy white growth all over it and dies. Anyone had that experience? Nobody has, okay. Well, anyway, not the kind of thing you want to get loose in an aquarium. These fungi are very good at getting into the systems of fish. The fewer avenues of such infection that you have if you live in a cold, dark cave all the time, the better off you probably are. So there's probably some selection against having eyes if you don't need them. And on top of that, the parts of the fish brain that are particularly sensitive to pressure and to odor have increased in size in these cave fish. Independently, in all the different introductions of cave fish, very similar changes have happened in these fish populations. Okay? And that makes sense because they've got to be able to smell things better, they've also got to be able to feel vibrations in the water better, and they do that through their lateral lines, which are structures that run along the sides of their bodies that are very sensitive to changing water pressure. The lateral lines, by the way, are structures that eventually evolved into the ears that we have. Our remote ancestors had lateral lines too. So that one example, I think, shows that, as I said, mutations are happening all the time, and that they can happen independently in different lineages of fish to give you surprisingly similar results. If you look at the fish in different caves, they look very alike. They're very closely related still to the species they came from. They're still part of the same species. But they've all independently lost their eyes, and they've all independently undergone these other evolutionary changes as well. The time scale here is probably a matter of perhaps a few tens of thousands of years. Not very long. These caves come and go. They open up, they disappear, So none of these, so far as anyone can tell, if you look at the genetic relatedness of the cave fish and the fish that live in the streams, they're very close to each other. There's virtually no difference between them. So in many cases, this has happened fast. It didn't take, millions of years or anything like that. Evolution can go faster than you think sometimes. So anyway, that, I think, gives you some feel maybe for how some of these things are happening. And helps to explain some of the great puzzles of evolution, some of the things that you'll be talking about, I expect, later on in the class. How many of you have heard of the Cambrian explosion? Some have, some haven't. Okay. The Cambrian explosion happened starting about 545 million years ago, at the beginning of the Cambrian. The Cambrian is the beginning of the age of multicellular organisms, organisms that really do leave substantial traces in the fossil record. Before the Cambrian, there were multicellular organisms, but many of them we can't figure out what they were. I mean, these fossils are, of course, pretty old and go back a long way, but on top of that, they don't look very much like anything that lived today. Some of them look more like jellyfish, but jellyfish don't usually leave much in the way of a fossil because jellyfish, break down very quickly. We don't know what they were. Before the Cambrian, before about 545 million years ago, most organisms, it appears, were too small, perhaps, and too simple to leave much of a trace in the fossil record. Recently, some pre-Cambrian fossils have been found that give us an idea of where these Cambrian organisms came from. But those fossils, I'll talk about those in a moment. Those fossils, I think, are a very important part of the whole story. If we look at the Cambrian explosion, if we look at the Cambrian explosion, we see something I think rather dramatic. Rather a complex looking thing here, but we'll sort of try to simplify it here a little bit for you. The boundary between the pre-Cambrian and the Cambrian, as I said, happened something on the order of 540 odd million years ago, as near as we can get to it. By 10 million years after that time, there were a lot of different organisms that left traces in the fossil record. So within 10 million years of the beginning of the Cambrian, and the Cambrian is about 70 million years long, so 1/7 of the way into the Cambrian, you've got a lot of different organisms that left all kinds of traces in the fossil record. You read about some of these organisms in a book by Stephen Jay Gould called Wonderful Life. I presume some of you probably have read that at one time or other. Gould claimed that the organisms that lived in the Cambrian, and the ones he was looking at lived somewhere in the middle of the Cambrian, and in China they've now found some that are much closer to the beginning of the Cambrian, and they look very much like the ones that live in the middle of the Cambrian. He claimed that many of these organisms were experiments, if you like, of evolution. These were organisms that were clearly different from anything that lives today. There were a few organisms, indeed, that were clearly different from anything that lives today, but it turns out that many of the organisms that people had thought were very different from what lives today turned out to be, for the most part, funny-looking arthropods, funny-looking relatives of the insects and the crustaceans. So, starting right from the beginning of the Cambrian, the majority of the organisms that you see are organisms that gave rise to the organisms that are now the most successful group of organisms on the planet. You may think we're very successful, but the arthropods, believe me, are a lot more successful than we are. If you ever had ants in your kitchen, you know how extremely successful they can be. So, right from the beginning of the Cambrian, then, you begin to see the pattern of organisms that you find at the present time, something that Gould argues didn't happen, but I think people are now coming around to the realization that most of these organisms really are relatives of present-day ones. There were a few groups of organisms that went extinct, but most of them essentially have lasted down to the present time. The Cambrian, then, this sudden increase in the number of organisms in the fossil record and in the types of organisms in the fossil record led to the proposal that there was a kind of explosion of different types of organisms in the Cambrian. Right? All of a sudden, some tremendous amount of evolution that happened in the early Cambrian that gave you a great variety of creatures. You see all these different organisms at the beginning of the Cambrian. The annelids, that is to say the segmented worms, the earthworms and creatures like that. Well, of course, they weren't earthworms in those days, there wasn't any earth. But nonetheless, they were, there were segmented worms then. You find them in at the beginning of the Cambrian. The clams, the squids, the octopuses, the flatworms, the bryozoa, which are organisms that live now in marine environments. Unless you're a scuba diver, you probably haven't seen them. The arthropods, the insects and the crustaceans, they were the big deal here. The roundworms, the priapulid worms, the chordates and the hemichordates, these are organisms that have the beginnings of a backbone, and essentially are the organisms that will eventually give rise to creatures like us. They too were present at the beginning of the Cambrian, as were our fairly close relatives, the echinoderms. It seems funny to us that we're more closely related to a starfish than we are to an arthropod. But it's true. Doesn't seem reasonable, does it? Starfish have radial symmetry, right? And we have bilateral symmetry. How on earth could you get, from essentially this enormous difference between organisms that essentially have such tremendously different body plans? Funny to think about that, but in fact it turns out that if you look at the embryology of a starfish, it becomes a little more understandable. Starfish larvae start out as being bilaterally symmetrical, and they kind of, as they develop, they sort of grow out of their armpits or thereabouts, a little lump which eventually then develops into the adult starfish or the adult sea urchin, and that lump is radially symmetrical. So a portion of that bilaterally symmetrical larva grows like a tumor out of the larva and becomes the adult organism. And now it's been possible to isolate some of the genes that are responsible for this process. It's kind of neat because some of those genes are also involved in our own development. So we can see, the relationship between the development of starfish and the development of humans. That relationship is not as different as we had thought it was a few years ago. So this connectedness then can be traced by looking at the phylogeny of genes, just as we did in that phylogenetic tree that I talked about yesterday. The relationship of different organisms can be built up by using the phylogeny of a variety of different genes. And if you do that, you can get some idea of how organisms differ, how they're grouped. You've essentially got three major group of organisms here. These are organisms that have hollow feeding tentacles or a particular type of larvae. These are organisms in which their integument is molted, their outer shell, so to speak, is molted periodically. We don't do that. We have an internal skeleton. We do things completely differently. And these are organisms that are going to include creatures like us eventually. And these organisms are essentially the beginnings of creatures with backbones. All this had happened by the beginning of the Cambrian. The question is, did it begin all at once? Okay. Preston Cloud wrote a rather nice paper a few years ago in which he asked the question, it was on the title of the paper, rather a memorable title, did the Cambrian explosion have a long fuse? Okay. Did the Cambrian explosion happen all at once, or was there a fuse sizzling along in the previous tens or hundreds of millions of years which then lit the Cambrian explosion? The answer seems to be there was a long fuse. Because as you trace the genes back, as well as we can put times on these various divergences, we find that these divergences happened long before the Cambrian, back in the pre-Cambrian. So this split between radially symmetrical organisms, true radially symmetrical organisms, which essentially are organisms that include things like the coral organisms and so on, that are radially symmetrical all their lives. That split between those and the bilaterally symmetrical organisms happened very, very early on, probably well before a billion years. Okay? Then another split happened between those that had one kind of larva here, blastula development here, and those that had another kind of blastula development. And that split happened, once again, very far back before the Cambrian. Then there was another split here between the two groups of protostomes, those that led essentially to these organisms with trochophore larvae and the organisms in which the integument is molted. and there are probably a lot of other organisms back here that have disappeared, intermediate types that are no longer present, and things that we don't pick up in the fossil record.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, on the tree of life that you show, whether it was the tendon proteins that last, would you part?
Yes, way up at the tip, exactly. They didn't have much to do with that. No, well, probably not nothing, in the sense that they were probably, because there were so many new ecological niches for these organisms, when there were so, after all, you know, before there were guts, there was no need to evolve an organism, a bacterium that lived in the guts, okay? So there were no E. coli-like organisms before that time. There were lots of new ecological niches for the prokaryotes, the organisms that don't have a true nucleus. But when you had all these new ecological niches, it probably spurred their divergence as well into many different types. Some that are specialized to be parasites, some specialized to be saprophytes, on the organisms that are radiating here in the Cambrian explosion. But we don't know anything about that because we don't have a fossil record. We can just tell from the present day diversity that it must have happened. We do have a fossil record here. What was going on back here? Why do we have a fossil record here? The fact that we don't has suggested to some people, well, it's so such a long time ago, maybe, you know, things were, you know, rough back then, and you know, fossils didn't get preserved. Maybe there were simpler versions of these three groups of organisms that go back before the Cambrian. But in fact, there's some pretty good rock deposits, deposits, which, if they'd happened a little bit later on, would probably be full of fossils that you find in the older rocks. So it doesn't seem likely that it's some fault in the way the Earth was made. You know, it doesn't seem likely that the reason we don't see Precambrian fossils, and not very many of them, it doesn't seem likely that that's because you couldn't lay down fossils. As I said, there are some Precambrian fossils, the so-called Vendian or Ediacaran fossils, that are found in a terrific state of preservation. Why don't you find more elaborate organisms with them if they existed? Well, recently, as I say, some Japanese workers have in fact found such organisms, but they're very small and very simple. They're very small, very simple organisms that look like the very early developmental stages of these organisms here. So it looks as if during this whole period, all this radiation was going on, and it involved little teeny-weeny, very simple organisms that never got to be very elaborate, never got to be very complex. And that probably was where an awful lot of evolution happened, an awful lot of this splitting among these different lineages happened. That's the long fuse that Preston Cloud was talking about. That long fuse that gradually increased the diversity of these little tiny organisms, so small, so difficult to see, that it's hard to find them in the fossil record. And then, come the Cambrian explosion, something really dramatic happened to the environment that caused them all to become bigger and more complex. Yes. The evidence for an environmental change exactly here is nil. There doesn't seem to be any obvious reason. You know, there were, however, a series of very severe glaciations that happened back before the Cambrian. Those severe glaciations froze over much of the world. And nobody knows what role they may have played in this explosion. It's also known that throughout this whole period, the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere was increasing. And it might be that it got to the point where, first of all, there was enough oxygen around so that bigger organisms could be supported. Bigger organisms need more oxygen if they're going to get big and complicated, you know, and if you want any kind of a metabolism at all. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that because now the atmosphere was more oxidizing, that had a series of sort of ripple effects. It changed the chemistry of the ocean so that it was actually possible now for more compounds, calcium, phosphates and carbonate compounds to be in solution in the oceans, which then allowed organisms to evolve to use these to make shells and things. And those shells, of course, are some of the things that we see in the fossil record. And there's probably a dozen other reasons why this happened. But whatever it was sudden. There really was a Cambrian explosion. But it had, the molecular evidence suggests, a long fuse. Yes? The reason for this is that biologists tend to be animalocentric, or whatever the term is, right? And yes. That's right. The reason you don't see much in the way of plants here is because most of the plants of that time, during the Cambrian, were very small and ocean-going organisms, okay? Most of the photosynthesis that goes on in the world even at the present time has nothing to do with the green plants we see around us. Some, of course, happens from local green plants. Most of it happens as a result of photosynthesis in the oceans. And a lot of that has to do with photosynthetic bacteria called blue-green algae that, in fact, contribute a very large amount to the oxygen in the atmosphere. And there are also a lot of other floating organisms that that contribute to that as well. Some of the earliest fossils we know of, which go back 3.5 billion years, look suspiciously like blue-green algae. They're not exactly like present-day blue-green algae. When you get to 2 billion years ago, the microfossils, which you can see if you take a piece of rock and polish it down to a very thin layer and shine light through it, the microfossils that you see embedded in these rocks look much more like present-day blue-green algae. 2 billion years ago, it really looks as if at that time there were lots of blue-green algae cracking out lots of oxygen. But there was no land here to speak of on which, right, there was land, but the organisms hadn't colonized the land at that point. The land was more or less empty. So there were no land plants. The first land plants turn up in the Ordovician, which is some distance down here. So there are, in fact, the first signs of land plants happen much later on. And so people sort of get excited about the Cambrian explosion because they're looking at this animal diversity, because after all, animals are more fun to work with than plants. But in fact, there probably was, and we know, of course, that plant diversity really began to take off, land plant diversity really began to take off later in the Paleozoic, at which time when they moved up, the ancestors of mosses and ferns began to move onto the land and then began to evolve towards the gymnosperms and the angiosperms. All that happened later on. And because of the animalocentric nature of an awful lot of biologists, people haven't paid as much attention to that. But it's happening. More and more of the plant evolution is beginning to be filled in. But that's a good point. If you happen to be very fond of plants, fear not. They come into their own somewhat later on. When you start really seeing the diversity of land plants, we're talking perhaps another 100 million years or so into the future, from the end of the century. Good question. Okay. So what we've got here then is a very, very dramatic and very startling event. And the question has always been, how could all this have happened at once? You know, what can have happened? What went on? Preston Cloud's idea that there was a long fuse to the Cambrian explosion gives us a clue to what might have happened. There presumably was a lot of diversity among these small, simple organisms in here. And that diversity then, when conditions changed, when the environment was ripe, that diversity allowed the organisms, all of them, to become bigger and more complicated and be much more likely to leave fossils behind in the fossil record. So the genetic groundwork essentially had been laid here. We know to some extent what that genetic groundwork may consist of.
I want to make sure I understood what you said about the genetic almost everybody now is descendant from the bilateral genetic line, and the fastest is only
Oh gosh! No, actually, the starfish are not on this radial line. No. Remember, I said they're bilaterally symmetrical as they begin to develop. They become radially symmetrical later on. It's a secondary appearance of radial symmetry in the case of the starfish and the sea urchins.
So, who is on this radial line?
Oh, things like corals and a number of other simple colonial organisms that essentially have radial symmetry right from the beginning.
But that's very rare.
No, there's lots of corals. Yes, right, sure, you know.
Are there any species of corals?
Loads of species of corals. You dive in a coral reef, you'll be blown away by the number of these symmetrical organisms that there are. Okay? So this split has left lots and lots of descendants. There are loads of descendants there. But a good point, nonetheless. I think that's an important point to make. You know, what we see now is It's true, these organisms didn't get to be really big and complicated with brains and stuff like that. And you might think, for example, that it seems funny that the echinoderms didn't get to be really intelligent either, but they've got a very specialized sort of life too. They, you know, they're useful for them to be bilaterally symmetrical, and they don't really have much in the way of brain power. But there are little organisms that in fact fall into a collateral branch here of the chordates. Little organisms called tunicates. Anybody seen a tunicate? Going a blank here? Tunicate, yeah, there is something that's not a mutate, right. Tunicates are little organisms that grow in both marine and the freshwater environment, particularly marine environments. Tunicates are little flask-shaped organisms that grow on the bottom, and they have two pores at the top. Water goes in one pore and out the other. These tunicates are filter feeders. They just sit there and they go, and they suck up the water that goes by, and they essentially catch what's in the water in their gills, okay, which are inside. They've got these rather complicated gills which act both as breathing organs and as organisms that trap food. So they've got a very simple life. You don't need to have much of a brain to be a tunicate, really. But the larvae of tunicates, it turns out, are bilaterally symmetrical. The tunicates are short of radially symmetrical. You know, they look like flasks, as I said. The larvae of tunicates are bilaterally symmetrical, and they look like little chordates. They swim about. They've got little notochords, little stiffening rods that run along their bodies. Okay, the tunicate larvae look like little tiny sort of fish-like creatures. They swim about, and then they settle down, and they turn into tunicates. So the larvae then possibly give us a glimpse of what some of these organisms might have been like back before the Cambrian. If there were creatures swimming around that were like tunicate larvae, and they never settled down, but they got bigger and bigger and more complicated, and their brains began to get bigger, then they would lead to creatures like us. Those that did settle down and take up this sort of echinoderm-like mode of existence where they became bilaterally symmetrical. Tunicates, by the way, are not echinoderms, they're another branch. But nonetheless, the same sort of thing seems to have happened with the tunicates. They've gone from radial to bilateral symmetry in a very different way from the way the echinoderms do it, but nonetheless the same kind of transition has happened. The tunicates then, the adult tunicates, have essentially lost their capability of swimming around, but they retained it as larvae. But if a mutation were to have happened in those creatures back then that allowed the larvae to become sexually mature before they became adults, then those larvae might conceivably have been able to pass those genes on to the next generation, and after a while you would have a group of tunicate larva-like organisms that could swim about and never become adults. Okay? And it is those sexually precocious organisms that quite possibly ended up looking like creatures like us. So that it's quite possible that it was sexual precocity that gave rise to our own species in the far distant past, of course. So once you begin to understand the relationships among all these different organisms, I think it becomes a lot clearer, you know, all the various stages that could have happened here. If you look at this Cambrian explosion and you scratch your head and you say, how the hell could evolution have done that? But if you then look at the growing number of tiny Precambrian fossils that are being found, and if you look at the evidence of the genes, you see that an awful lot of very small changes happened, a lot of very small steps happened in the course of this evolution. So if people present to you the argument, and creationists tend to do this kind of thing, if people present to you the argument that evolution could never have happened, look at the Cambrian explosion, you know, God must have done it. In fact, we now have growing evidence that there were all sorts of perfectly straightforward step-by-step evolutionary processes, sometimes involving fairly big steps, but nonetheless, all of them, I think, explicable at the genetic level, that gave rise to something as remarkable as this. Not an increase in numbers of organisms as so much as an increase in their size and complexity. Okay? So before that time, you had organisms, the fossils that have been found are organisms, fossils of organisms that had just a few cells. Okay? It's as if you caught the development of a human within the first few hours of development. Okay? And you fossilized that. That is the kind of thing that we find back here. organisms that look like these very, very early stages of larval development of a variety of different types. Whether they were, in fact, really larvae, or whether they were complete adult organisms that were swimming around and doing stuff, even though they were very small and simple, we don't know. But it's possible that's the case. Maybe we just simply haven't found the more elaborate ones, but it might be that this is as elaborate as they got. Okay? Then, when you get here, you find, I'm sorry I didn't bring a picture of it, but you find a great variety of different creatures, some of them rather startling looking, that appear very, very quickly in the fossil record. And with amazing suddenness in the fossil record. So it's not a case of numbers so much as it is a case of increase in size and complexity. Okay. Yeah. Oof, yes, please. Yes, much earlier than the Cambrian, for sure. Organisms were chowing down on each other much earlier than that. Interestingly, bacteria sort of tend not to engulf other bacteria. I don't know of many cases of that happening. But very simple eukaryotic organisms can, in fact, engulf bacteria. Single-cell eukaryotic organisms will engulf and eat bacteria. If you ever raised the paramecium in the paramecia in the in a little bowl when you were a kid, okay, these little creatures, little slipper-like, almost invisible creatures. They're so small that you can just barely see them with the naked eye if you shine a bright light on them. Paramecia will eat bacteria, and they're very small organisms. They're very simple organisms. They're simpler indeed than many of the organisms you have here, but they're part of a food chain already. Those food chains must have been established very early on, and we don't know a lot about the evolution of these food chains because, of course, the further back you go, the lousier the fossil record gets. And the tougher it is to figure out what's happening with these tiny organisms. It's really a pain to grind these rocks down to thin layers and shine light through them. It is not easy to do. And you have to be very patient, you know, to see what kinds of creatures there might be in there. And then you run into argumental people say, well, it's just an artifact, you know, it's just a funny looking object you found under there. You have to find lots of them to convince people that they're real. So that kind of argument about what kinds of creatures they were and who ate who is something that I suppose will continue for a long time. But for sure, there were substantial food chains established a long time ago. There was a real ecology there. In fact, if you look at the ecology of Precambrian organisms, there's a nice example of this kind of thing here. The picture's not awfully good, I'm afraid, but essentially, these sort of lump-like things that you see here growing in shallow water in Shark Bay in Western Australia are structures called stromatolites, and they consist of layer upon layer of bacteria and blue-green algae that grow in mats one on top of the other. And such stromatolite-like structures have been found as early as 3.5 billion years ago. So you've already had rather complex ecosystems here that probably look rather like this. If you go back 3.5 billion years, you'd probably find structures like this, which are made up of many different organisms all living together. You'd probably find those organisms, structures that were very much like that. But I don't have anything that shows the next step in evolution, because we don't really know what the next step was. But it was certainly more than just a bunch of bacteria swimming around, you know? When we think of the very ancient world, the very beginning of life, we think of, you know, bacteria just sort of floating about, right? That's where we normally think of it. But it rather looks as if right from the beginning, the bacteria were becoming organized into groups and clusters. As you probably know, there are very, very complex bacterial ecosystems everywhere in the world. Bacteria that interact with each other in very complex ways. On the surface of our teeth, for example, there are bacterial ecosystems. Those of us who brush, I'm afraid, still can't get rid of them. These bacterial ecosystems are really tough, and they do all sorts of things. And some of the bacteria can cause tooth decay and things like that. So bacterial ecosystems, even our own bodies, are sums of many different groups of organisms working together. Even something as simple as bacteria have substantial ecosystems, substantial degrees of organization among them. And that's, I think, a good point to remember. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. How are we doing, by the by? Let's see, we've got another half hour. Do we really want to slog on for another half hour? Do you want a bit of a break, stretch? We just keep going here? Yes, all right. Sure. Okay, but what I wanted to do essentially, before you start getting into the molecular details, which you'll be bogged down with, I think, in the rest of this course, we'll really be looking in great detail about how genes change over time and how to build phylogenetic trees and stuff. Remember, if you'd be so good, what the end result of all this is, right? The astounding diversity of life on the planet. The astounding number of ways in which organisms can evolve in smallish steps to give rise to the huge number of adaptations that we see in the world around. Okay? I think it's, you know, important to remember that if you start getting into the molecular details, because otherwise you worry about, you know, transitions and transversions and things, and you tend to ignore what the end product of all this is, which I think is the most exciting part of evolution. So what did it all end up doing? How did we appear? How did other organisms appear? The same set of organisms. That's interestingly a question which occurred to Stephen Jay Gould, and he got a best-selling book out of it called Wonderful Life. The question is, suppose you were to repeat the tape of life, I think was the analogy that he used. You could wind the tape back and repeat it again. Would we get the same result? Not exactly, no. I think you probably get something more similar to the present-day world than Gould argued. And the reason for that is that, as I said, even if you wound the tape of life back before the Cambrian, by that time there was already a sort of divergence of organisms that would lead towards things like arthropods and things like chordates. Okay? So you'd probably end up with arthropods and chordates. Wind it even further back to the beginning of eukaryotic life itself, and then replay it, and what would you get? The answer is probably rather startlingly different things sometimes, but you'd end up with carnivores and herbivores, you'd end up with big organisms and little ones, you'd end up with flying organisms, you'd end up with swimming organisms. Swimming organisms would look very much like swimming organisms today. There are only so many ways you can swim through the water. If you're shaped like an umbrella, it's pretty dumb to be shaped like an umbrella if you want to swim through the water, okay? You've got to be shaped like a fish. And in fact, lots and lots of organisms have converged on being shaped like a fish over and over again in the course of evolution. Absolutely, yes. No tomatoes, no potatoes, no whatever, yes. No peppers, no. It is a big difference, exactly. Yeah, quite right. The diversity that we see in the world at the present time is indeed very dramatic, and such that we can find, have found in different parts of the world as we've explored them, remarkable cuisine, remarkable organisms, and so on. Everywhere we look, we find different things. The question is, in a world of the future, the details would be different, but you'd still find the same general classes of organisms, at least. And I suspect that you'd probably find organisms that had backbones or something like it. It's a pretty sensible way to go. You'd certainly find organisms that had a head at one end and a tail at the other. And you find organisms that had legs, all right? Well, insects tend to have 6 legs, people tend to have 4, or, you know, creatures like us tend to have 4 legs. Would we have ended up with 6-legged mammals? Would we have ended up with 4-legged insects? Dunno, you know. Would we have ended up with 8-legged? Well, we do. We have 8-legged spiders, okay? Could we have found 8-legged mammals? I'm not so sure, really, that there's much point to our having 8 legs, to tell the truth. Because mammals are big and complicated enough that they can even learn to stand around on 2 legs. Insects are small, and they have rather small brains. And, of course, there's been marvelous experiments to show that if you've got 6 legs, you're very stable. You know, you tend not to fall over, and you tend to be able to scramble over rather rough terrain. So if you're a teeny-weeny creature, confronted by very rough terrain, it makes a lot of sense to have a reasonable number of legs. There are organisms like centipedes and millipedes, and they have enormous numbers of legs. So even at the present day, we have an enormous diversity of different types. Whether we'd end up with great big herbivores and carnivores in age with numbers of legs, I think probably not. If you're an herbivore and you've got lots of legs, you can't really run very fast, it'll be tripping over each other, okay? So you're probably more likely to have legs that will allow you to run fast. And you don't need a lot of legs to do that, maybe. If you want to run fast, maybe four legs is a pretty good number to have if you're a big organism. Of course, yes. How likely is it that intelligence would evolve if you played the tape of life over again? As you probably know, the search for intelligence in other parts of the universe has been rather unsuccessful up to this point. Nobody has yet picked up emissions of the equivalent of I Love Lucy, you know, from other planets. Not for want of trying. People have tried very hard and they've really explored a fair amount of the distance and the range of possible wavelengths under the where you might be able to pick up such a signal. My answer, though, and the argument that the SETI people have is that if you get a planet that's like ours, that could in fact develop complicated multicellular life, that the chance eventually of getting intelligent life is very high, so that sooner or later it'll happen. Now, it took 3.8 billion years on our planet for that to happen. On other planets, it might have happened faster. Interestingly, there might have been more things like meteorite impacts that could have sped evolution up, you know, planets that might have had a greater variety of different mineralogies so that it was possible to have a more diverse physical environment, such as it might have pushed evolution along faster. Other planets, it might have been much slower. But it might be, anthropic principle aside, it might be that 3.8 billion years is about as fast as you can do it. You know, so it might be that there aren't a lot of such intelligent organisms out there. The reason I suspect, though, that the probability of eventually getting to an intelligent organism is very close to one, is because if you look at the evolution of brains in various organisms over long periods of time, not just in our own species, not just since we were chimpanzee-like creatures 5 million years ago, but if you look at evolution of brains in many different organisms, many different groups of organisms, you discover that over time, on average, these brains have been getting bigger and bigger. Brains of present-day birds are much larger than the brains of the birds of the Mesozoic. Brains of present-day mammals, on average, are much larger than the brains of the mammals of the Mesozoic, relative to their body size. You factor body size out and you can get a so-called encephalization quotient, which allows you to see how big the brains are relative to the body. It's not a linear relationship, but one that you can work out. Well, it is linear on a log scale. So all that's going on. Dinosaurs, too, had rather small brains, but birds, the descendants of some of the dinosaurs, have much larger brains, okay? So there's been a general trend towards larger brain size. Harry Jerrison at UCLA has demonstrated that if you look at the mammals of the early age of mammals, they have much smaller brains than present-day mammals. So there's been a general trend towards bigger and bigger brains, and we're just part of that trend. So it's not as if all of a sudden intelligence happened as a result of a sudden chance mutation. Brains have been getting bigger, behavior has been getting more complex for a very, very long period of time. I keep coming back to the continuity of this whole thing. There's a continuity to the evolutionary process that people who come to the field for the first time tend not to know about because they haven't seen, you know, all the accumulating evidence from the fossil record that shows that there is such a continuity. Does that sort of answer your question? So my contention is that if you get a planet sort of like ours and you wait a reasonable amount of time, you'll get organisms that have bigger and bigger brains. And sooner or later, these creatures that finally be intelligent could be arthropods, you know. They don't need to be vertebrates. Maybe there's enough oxygen in the atmosphere that you can get really big arthropods and they can become intelligent. You know, all sorts of possibilities. Yeah. Yes, there's lots of evidence for offshoots of organisms in which intelligence, the complexity of the neural system decreases over time, right. Parasitic worms, for example, have just enough nerves to get them by. They don't have much at all. Their free-living relatives have much more complex nervous systems. Becoming parasitic was a good deal for them, but they lost the ability to think about it. And that kind of trend, nothing about evolution says that you should get more and more complex. When Harry Jerrison plotted out just, I think this is an important point to make. I don't know. I don't know how we can just raise this for a moment. Somebody knows how to work that? Terrific. Courage. Oh, here's the white one. We could bring that down again in a moment, but let me just show you what happened when Harry Jerison looked at brain sizes of the first mammals and compared them with brain sizes of mammals in the middle of the age of mammals and then present day mammals. What he found was the mammals at the beginning of the age of mammals had a distribution of brain sizes like this, right? And this is your encephalization quotient, so you've factored out body size here. And mammals at the sort of halfway through the age of mammals had a distribution that looked sort of like this. And mammals of the present time have a distribution that looks like this. So the mean size of the brains of mammals has in fact increased over time, but so has the variance. Okay? So you've still got some mammals that are really dumb. But they don't need to be smart. If you're a rhinoceros, you don't need a big brain because you're a rhinoceros. Nobody's going to fool with you. You don't need to be have a giant intellect or anything like that. So rhinos tend to be down sort of at this end of the encephalization quotient. Humans happen to be up at this end. But you can see the trend here. What's happened, even during the last 65 million years, has been a substantial increase in the mean. But not to say that some organisms haven't been left behind for good evolutionary reasons. And I would imagine, if you look carefully, you'd see that some organisms probably went down. As evolution proceeded, they might have gotten stupider rather than smarter, as in the case of. But I don't know many specific examples of that. But I imagine if you look closely, you could find some. Mm-hmm.
This is obviously very, very complicated. This subject
is
quite exciting.
Sure.
So far, it's often quoted
as. Yes.
And the brain, but then you just measure brain size.
Humans have something on the order of three and a half times the brain size of chimpanzees. Right, it's a substantial difference. An enormous qualitative difference.
It's five studies.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps not in navigating.
Yes, but remember, we've had 5 million years of evolution, during which probably there's been a big premium put on the increase in intelligence, because once you get to organisms two and a half million years ago that began to make tools, specifically making stone tools, in with lots of pressure to get even smarter. So
what is the probability that you run your big crawlers that you need enough that it can be useful?
And then just stop.
Yeah.
Well, yes, it might do. I mean, evolution tends not to get stuck. I mean, well, I have a hunch that once we get beyond a certain point, I mean, don't forget that this is something that has probably been powered primarily by the increasing complexity of the physical environment of these organisms, but also by the increasing intelligence of predators and prey. Interestingly, when Jerison looked at predators and prey back here, he found that predators tend to have bigger brain sizes than their prey. That is to say, carnivores had bigger brain sizes than herbivores did. When he gets out to here, he finds that carnivores and herbivores have about the same range of brain sizes, which is, I think, kind of fun, indicating the herbivores have caught up. You know, if you've ever watched animals in an African watering hole, and as the evening is drawing nigh, and the animals are coming down to drink, what you find, of course, is that these animals, which are about to be preyed on by something, are really nervous, and they're watching everywhere, and they're very, very worried about what they're doing. It's tough to be a prey these days, you know. To survive, you've got to be as smart, it would appear, as the predator.
And the brain size fossils,
yes. So you could fossil crania, you can measure the brain capacity, and then factor in the body size and work out what the EQ is. And there's enough data, I think, to show rather nicely that from Jerison's analysis that there really has been a big, big change. Yeah. And that big change has been driven not by the kinds of things we think of as human intelligence. But once you get to a certain point, then you start to see, I think, some pretty dramatic alterations. Chimpanzees have the beginnings of culture. Chimpanzees in different parts of Africa use different kinds of tools.
Yeah, but that's very far from what the study.
Of course it is, that's right. Chimpanzees can't send old I Love Lucy programs into outer space, okay, so they've got a long way to go. Well, it's been a mere 5 million years since we and the chimpanzees parted company, 5 million years of separate evolution. during which time, so far as we can tell, if you go further back in the hominid fossil record, the lineage that led to us, you find that our ancestors look more and more chimpanzee-like. And so probably by the time you get back to 5 million years, they weren't terribly different in morphology, at least, from chimps. So I suspect their behavior was simpler. Which chimps have, of course, not sat still. But we've evolved like hell. We've gone like crazy during this time. Our ancestors 5 million years ago, if you had one in front of you, you'd think, gosh, that's a chimpanzee, okay? But the amount of change that's happened in our brain size, in our morphology, our hands have changed dramatically. A chimpanzee's hand is useful, but nowhere near as useful as ours, because a chimpanzee has got a conflict here. It uses its hand for manipulating, it uses its hand for walking, and you know, it, as a result, it's a hand that isn't awfully good at either one of these things. So chimpanzees and humans have undergone very different amounts of evolution. Chimpanzees, relatively little morphological change. Humans, a huge amount of morphological change and brain size increase. What's driven that difference, I suspect, has to do with the fact that there's a tremendous premium put on intelligence once you get to a certain point. Pressures brought to bear as a result of greater degrees of socialization. Pressures brought to bear because it's now necessary to communicate complicated ideas to other members of the group. Pressures brought to bear on whether or not you can make a decent stone tool or a decent wooden implement that allows you to hunt better and so on. All these pressures, by a kind of feedback process, have accelerated human evolution dramatically, and for whatever reason, it didn't catch the chimpanzee. Would these pressures happen in other planets? If you had a lot of organisms running around that had brains as big as chimpanzees in different parts of these planets, I'm sure sooner or later this feedback would begin to happen. It's not that it's likely to stop there if there are ecological opportunities available for organisms, then organisms will sure as hell evolve to take care of those ecological opportunities. The further back you go, the fewer points you have here. No, I don't think you could say that. What you do see, yes, in other words, they're sort of normal, you know, in a sort of normalish kind of way. Okay? Other than creation. Remember, we've factored that out. Body size has been factored out here. Or height or whatever. Well, lots of other things are going on in these mammals. You know, tooth size is changing, numbers of toes on the feet can change in the case of the horses and the other lithic terns and other organisms that are horse-like and that underwent separate evolution. Now, the answer is no, they're all over the map. Okay, organisms have gotten smaller, they've gotten larger over time. Horses in general, for example, have gotten bigger over time, their numbers of toes have gotten smaller, and that's been sort of used as an example of an evolutionary phenomenon that's called orthogenesis. Evolution is being driven in a particular direction, and it can't stop, they keep going, right? You know, there's something built into evolution that makes horses bigger and with more complex grinding teeth. And the growth of the variance with time tells you that orthogenesis isn't operating here. Some of these animals have been selected for increased brain size. Others have not. They've been selected to keep their brain sizes where they are. Okay? And there's perhaps a lot of back and forth here that we don't know about. Yes. Right. Your question was, do we have enough data to do that? The answer is no, we don't. There's not enough data to do anything as detailed as that. It would be nice if we did. I mean, but there, I think we might lose some of the details. You'd have to ask what kind of carnivores. Sure. Oh, well, we know at the present time that there are huge mammals and teeny-weeny mammals. There are some mammals about as big as your fingernail. And there are other mammals, you know, like elephants and whales, that are really, really big. At the present time, so far as we can tell, the biggest extreme, well, we don't know, I guess, you know, there are extremes of present-day mammals that are beyond anything that's been found in the fossil record. Okay? So there are bigger animals alive today, in the case of the giant filter-feeding whales, that are bigger than anything we've ever found in the fossil record. There are smaller animals today, in the case of some of the shrews, that are smaller than anything that's ever been found in the fossil record. Now, it could be that we simply haven't found them yet. or it could be, that the diversity of animals has actually increased, simply because there are more ecological opportunities now than there were then. Maybe, we don't know. But it's all over the map. Okay. The width of the distribution is indeed an increasing function of time, and any number of things perhaps could drive that. My guess is that it's ecological diversity and the complexity of the environment which is driving it. As ecological niches increase in numbers, then the diversity of the animals that fill them will also increase. For example, if you look here, back here, at the beginning of the age of mammals, there were no grasslands. Okay? Grasses were just sort of beginning to diversify. When you get to here, you have substantial grasslands covering much of the planet. But before that time, you had little bushes and you had trees, and that was about it. Grasses had not diversified to make the grazing ecosystems that many mammals were then able to use. So as animals began to evolve, as horses did, in the direction of being able to use grasslands, then I think you can see that the possibility for ecological diversity became much greater. And maybe, you know, they got bigger, and maybe they had to run faster, maybe they had to become more alert because the predators were getting faster too. Then, you know, this kind of chasing that goes on, this co-evolution that happens, is going to be driving this whole process. So you can't reduce it to a simple physical process here. It's more complicated than that. Yeah, okay. And the answer is, I don't think it's good enough to do anything terribly decent in the matter. But the trend is there.
One way of addressing Ivy's question is to sort of the question that's based on this notion of neutrality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Is it a part, a similar part for reptiles and for mammals? Do you have a sort of similar?
That's right. If you look at present-day reptiles, there's not really enough data, I think, to do the kind of detailed analysis that Garrison did on the mammals. But if you look at present-day reptiles of a given body size and compare them with the reptiles of the Mesozoic, the age of dinosaurs, these reptiles have a bigger EQ than those reptiles did. Similarly with the birds here and the birds there. The birds there have much smaller brains on average than the birds here. So it looks sort of like orthogenesis, okay? It looks like there's some ineluctable evolutionary law which is driving organisms towards greater brain size or whatever, or relative brain size. No, they don't have the same shape. The variance goes up. Yeah, I mean, when you scale the distribution by adjusting for the mean size, yes, it's roughly the same. But as I say, the data points aren't enough to really, I think, say anything about any differences. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but if you're trending towards saying, God, there has to be some simple equation that describes all this. Yes, exactly. The question would be, are they random processes that produced this? My contention, I think Jerison's contention would be, no, they aren't random. There's something happening here that is in fact increasing ecological complexity and therefore the diversity of themselves. Yeah, okay, right. Sorry, I may not be grasping what you're getting at here. Sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking like a physicist is my problem here. I have a feeling we're both at fault here, yes, right. In the sense that we're both trying to look at the same phenomenon in very, very different ways. And I think, you know, it would be fun to see what kind of agreement we can come to as we look at that further. I was going to tell you a little bit about some further examples of co-evolution that have to do with the evolution of the AIDS virus. Something that I expect you'll be hearing a lot about as the course proceeds. Let me just sort of at the end of all this give you a little bit of what's going on here. A few years ago, Jerry Myers and I had a look at the evolution of AIDS viruses, which, as some of you perhaps know, come in two different varieties, HIV-1 and HIV-2. The viruses cause AIDS. AIDS is a disease of the immune system in which certain classes of cells T4 lymphocytes and macrophages, to be precise, are killed by the virus. So you end up with a defective immune system. That defective immune system makes you far less resistant to certain kinds of infections. Certain bacterial, fungal, and other kinds of infections are far more likely to run rampant in the body of a person with such a damaged immune system than a person who has a still functional immune system. And it is those so-called opportunistic infections that kill the person who has AIDS. A great variety of different things essentially happen to that person. Now, as we know, of course, the viruses are fairly recent arrivals in the human species. It rather looks as if perhaps the first jump from African monkeys and apes to humans, and these jumps happened, it appears, several times. The first jumps might have happened as recently as the 1930s, and some would argue perhaps even as recently as the 1950s. Those jumps across from one species to another are called zoonotic transfers, those of you who collect this kind of terminology. These are essentially transfers. We experience zoonotic transfers of other viruses all the time, of course. Flu viruses, of course, make a jump from pig populations across to human populations every year in southern China, and you get a new flu coming up. That's a brand new zoonotic transfer that happens. And every year, the people at the Centers for Disease Control and elsewhere work very long hours to try to figure out what the hell new kind of virus is going to make this transfer this year, so that they can try to immunize as many people as they can against this zoonotic transfer. So pigs and wading birds are pools, essentially, of viruses which repeatedly make zoonotic transfers across to humans. Okay? So that's happening. It appears that zoonotic transfers have happened several times from a variety of different organisms, a variety of different apes and monkeys that live in Africa, particularly in Central Africa, and have made a number of jumps, 10 or 12 different jumps across to humans. The likelihood is that HIV-1, the most dangerous of the two viruses, made that jump, or made those jumps, from chimpanzee populations to humans. We don't have absolutely firm evidence on this, but it's looking more and more as if the chimpanzees are the source of these viruses. As far as we can tell, the chimpanzees, which have very similar viruses to HIV, seem not to suffer harmful effects from these viruses. It looks as if the chimpanzees and the viruses have co-evolved to the point where they don't suffer from them. HIV-2, which is in humans largely confined to Central and Western Africa, is a less virulent disease. People will die of AIDS if they're infected with HIV-2. But the disease tends to develop more slowly, and indeed there are some people who've been infected with HIV-2 for decades and they haven't developed AIDS. So you've got two rather different viruses here. HIV-1, which I've shown here as jumping across, in this particular case, from chimpanzees, HIV-2, which has essentially jumped across from monkeys rather than from apes, and made that jump several times into humans. A different zoonotic transfer for HIV-2, or a series of zoonotic transfers for HIV-2 than for HIV-1. Okay? I don't show this here, but in fact, what's being shown here is the entire genome of the viruses which I've built a phylogenetic tree from. Okay, so you can build the phylogenetic tree essentially from this entire genome.
So is this the same as a tree of life?
It's the same kind of thing as a tree of life, exactly. Somewhere in the middle of this tree was the origin of all these. Okay, the yellow here is just simply that I've simply drawn this in to connect them all up. You've got different, yeah, essentially to connect them. These are the ancestors. We don't know anything about the ancestors, okay? Except that we know they're related in this various way, in these various ways. It's striking that HIV-2, which came across from sooty manga bays, we've got some of these little guys down here, HIV-2, the sooty manga bays got here, the sort of the dark yellow ones, I'm sorry, I'm running out of colors here. It didn't show up awfully well, I'm afraid. But the sooty manga bay virus has jumped across to humans several times. You can see that the sooty manga bay virus was very different from the chimpanzee viruses, which are these guys here in light green. Hori Mangabe virus is very different from the chimpanzee virus, okay? And we know, therefore, since these, because we actually have some branches of these viruses where very close relatives of the viruses have been found both in sooty mangabeys and in humans, the likelihood is that it made this jump across from humans. So what you've got here are viruses which, because they've recently arrived in humans, are quite damaging. And indeed, if these viruses are transferred to other monkeys that have never seen such a virus, it can be damaging as well. Macaque monkeys have also picked up HIV-2. And they've done so because macaques, which come from Asia and have never seen any of these viruses, were put in animal facilities along with sooty mangabeys, and the sooty mangabeys gave them the virus. When the macaques get the virus, they develop AIDS and they die. Okay? So the macaques, too, have had no evolutionary history of being infected with this kind of virus. Everybody with me on that? Okay? So, we've got then a situation in which you have zoonotic transfers here between monkeys at this end and humans, zoonotic transfers between apes, almost certainly chimpanzees, and humans at this end. Probably there's more stuff going on here, but we haven't yet found out what it is. Well, what Jerry Myers and I did was to look at the question of the evolution of these viruses and ask, is there something different about the way these viruses evolve? If you look at the total amount of divergence among the HIV-2s, which are these purple branches down here, and the HIV-1s, which are these red branches, they're not terribly different. It looks like HIV-2s are roughly as diverse as HIV-1s. A little bit more divergence among HIV-1s than there is HIV-2s, but there isn't a huge difference. And yet, HIV-1 is so much more virulent than HIV-2. So what's going on? Why are there any differences that we can determine from their evolution? Well, I'm about to explain that to you.
Why is there so much fewer divergences?
People haven't studied them, okay? Yeah, actually, this is an old slide. There'd be a lot more branches here, but nowhere near as many as this. Obviously, everyone's intensely interested in these. It's just a bias from the fact that people are much more interested in sequencing human genes, human HIV genomes, than they are sequencing those. But if you were able to look, as in fact has been done, there are a few cases here, the African green monkeys, for example, have been looked at in much more detail. This branch has gotten much more complicated. Okay, so a lot of divergence happening there. Sorry, that's a good point. Okay, so it's really an experimental bias, so to speak. Okay. What can you look at? Well, one thing that we thought to look at was a phenomenon called sequons. I won't go into a lot of detail on sequons, but if you look at the gene that's responsible for the outer membrane coat of the virus, the envelope gene, which codes for the big envelope protein of the virus, this is a very important protein because it's the protein that interacts with the host. Okay, the host sees this. This is what stimulates antibodies to the virus. This is the molecule that essentially binds in some cases to certain host cells and can allow the virus to get into the host cells and kill them. So it's a busy molecule. It does all kinds of stuff. This molecule is covered with sugars. And in fact, many of the protein molecules on the surface of our cells and the surface of many other organisms are covered with sugars, chains of sugar molecules. We think of proteins as proteins, right? Everyone thinks of proteins as a collection of amino acids. That's what you were taught. In fact, most proteins, particularly those on the surface of cells, have other things attached to them. They may have sugars attached to them. They may have fats attached to them. All kinds of things are stuck on these proteins. Okay? Now, it happens that the sites at which these sugars are attached to the protein are specified by a certain amino acid sequence called a sequon. And that specific amino acid sequence consists of a series of three amino acids. The one in the middle doesn't matter, but the ones at the two ends are important. So if you start with an asparagine, you can have anything in the middle, and you can finish up with a serine or a threonine, you've got a sequon, which is a point of attachment of one of these sugars in the gene. Everybody with me on that? So you've got these little points of attachment. Sequences are also specified by particular sequences of bases. 9 bases, right? Because each amino acid is specified by 3 bases. So each sequon consists of 3 adjacent codons. One codon specifies an asparagine. The second one can specify any amino acid. The third one can specify a serine or a threonine. Now, you can think of a sequon then as being a little marker, a little evolutionary marker, so to speak. The sequon is something that marks perhaps a rather important feature of the protein, because really where the sugar attaches to the protein and the kind of sugar that's attached is going to have a big impact on how the human host sees this virus. Everybody with me? Okay. So you can build a sequon tree. When you think about it, all it might take would be one base change in a sequon, and you could destroy the sequon. The sequon would disappear because now you no longer have the right sequence of amino acids. Similarly, you could have another sequence somewhere else in the gene that's almost a sequon, just one base away from being a sequon. Make that change, and all of a sudden you get a sequon. Okay? So sequons come and go. They switch on and off, if you like, on the tree. Okay? So the sequons may be a sequon here. The set of sequons in these genes here could be in completely different places from the set of sequons in these genes. There's been a lot of sequon evolution, it turns out, in these genes, as well as base evolution. The sequon evolution is the result of base change. Okay, everyone with me? Okay. Base changes ultimately cause sequons to appear or disappear. The number of sequons in the envelope genes of HIV-1 and HIV-2 are really quite similar. There are about 40 or so sequon sites in these genes. But the places where they are can change over time. So you can think of sequons as being like base changes. Okay, sequon changes can be treated in exactly the same way phylogenetically as base changes can, because you can see them come and you can see them go. So you can build a tree using sequons, and when you do, you get a rather different tree from this one. What you see here is that not very much sequon change has happened in HIV-2. There hasn't been a lot of sequon evolution in HIV-2. They haven't blinked on and off very much. But you see what's happened with HIV-1. The sequons are going like hell. They are in fact evolving roughly 3 times as fast in HIV-1 as they are in HIV-2, relative to the number of base changes. Okay? So essentially, if you look at the rate of sequon change as compared with the rate of base changes, you've discovered that sequons are now evolving 3 times as fast here as here, which means that a much larger fraction of the base changes in HIV-1 are affecting sequons than are affecting sequons in HIV-2. Even though both genes have roughly the same number of sequons, there's a hell of a lot more activity at the sequon level in HIV-1. Now, we know that HIV-1 is more virulent than HIV-2. We also know that HIV-1 turns over in the body much faster than HIV-2 does. HIV-1 and the host's immune system fight a terrible battle during the whole course of the infection. And HIV-1's viruses are turning over and evolving within an individual host at a tremendous rate, because, of course, HIV is in fact evolving at a very high rate. Limited evidence, because people haven't paid as much attention to HIV-2. After all, it affects Africans, it doesn't affect Americans. Limited evidence suggests that the turnover rate of HIV-2 is very much less than the turnover rate of HIV-1. So I would contend that maybe this switching around of sugar molecules on the surface of the envelope gene might have something to do with the fact that HIV-1 is a more effective pathogen than HIV-2. It's spread further, it's gone right around the world, it's affected far more people. They're up to 150 million, whatever the number is now. It's a lot of people. And the rate of evolution of HIV-1, it appears, is such that it is able perhaps to adapt to larger numbers of groups of people, be able to spread more quickly. And some of that maybe has to do with the fact that it's not just base changes that are happening here, it's the kinds of base changes that are important. The kinds of base changes that affect the sequons might be important in this kind of thing. For the most part, the original base changes are random, because these viruses have a lousy copying system. Their polymerase makes a lot of mistakes. when it makes copies of the RNA, it makes lots and lots of errors. Okay? So the rate of evolution is incredibly high in these viruses. Lots of mutations. Unbelievable numbers of mutations. Within a single individual human, you can find a huge diversity of viruses which have arisen from the few viruses that first arrived in that human. So that can go like crazy. But the randomness of the original changes has been sorted out by selection. And you now end up with a much larger fraction of those surviving changes affecting sequons in HIV-1 than are affecting sequons in HIV-2. There's a non-randomness here that's overlaid the random process.
Is the evolutionary genetics of the science, is it in a position to actually sort of estimate or predict the likelihood of possibility of various directions in the case? So in particular, one reads about, you know, one catastrophic scenario is that the HIV virus becomes airborne.
Mm, exactly.
You know, half the human race is like
And
so, are you people able to sort of estimate the likelihood of something like that?
It's tough to estimate that. Like, did everyone hear that question? Yes? No? But the question is it possible to predict something frightening like the HIV virus becoming airborne and spreading, you know, or, yes, right, or being picked up by mosquitoes or something and getting spread by mosquitoes, any number of awful possibilities. Is it possible to predict that possibility? The answer, I think, is yes, it is. As you gain more and more data on HIV, and as you see how it spreads around the world, and we now have a hell of a lot more HIVs in the world than we did a few decades ago, you can then ask, have they made such a jump? And the answer seems to be, so far, they haven't.
So,
in the future, you can estimate that the probability is very small, but I don't think I'd want to go much further than that. You really don't know what could conceivably happen here. Whether the thing about the viruses is very fragile, and that's the reason that they don't last very long, and you don't catch them in toilet seats or anything like that. They really are essentially much more likely to be destroyed outside the body. But there are plenty of other examples of pathogens that have, you know, survived outside the body. Syphilis, for example, is an organism that's transmitted only sexually, but there are relatives of syphilis that are transmitted by bodily contact, just simple bodily contact. And they're very close relatives, very, very, very close relatives of syphilis, okay? I mean really close, so close that it's been very hard to find any genetic differences between them. So it's conceivable that this could happen. I wouldn't want to rule it out. I'm sorry? Yes, exactly so. They all struck at the same time. The reason was that the pneumonic form of the plague, which is the one where people breathe out the bacteria, happens when you get a tremendous increase in the number of bacteria, and people get so many bacteria at once that they multiply in the bloodstream, break into the lungs, and get breathed out. Okay? If you have a much smaller number of bacteria out there, then they're more likely to be transferred by fleas that jump from rats to humans or from other rodents to humans. As you probably know, every year in California there are half a dozen or so cases of bubonic plague where somebody picked up this bacterium by, you know, incautiously feeding golden-mantled ground squirrels in Yosemite Park or something like that. So this occasionally happens, and some people die. Every year, there are one or two people who die of bubonic plague. That's not the scary bubonic plague. The scary one is when you've got a medieval crowded city or a crowded city in India at the present time where everyone's squeezed in together and the plague begins to multiply at a tremendous rate. So far as anyone knows, the bacteria in these two types of plague aren't terribly different from each other. It's not as if they were different races. But there could be a mutation or two that happens in some of them that helps the process along. But the bacteria seem to be pretty uniform. You can get pneumonic plague, essentially, from a bubonic plague outbreak every time, so to speak, provided conditions are right. Now, in the case of the HIVs, how big a jump did it have to be to make HIV-1? How many failed jumps were there? How many times did people eat chimpanzees, you know, and not get the virus? We don't know. We have no idea how often that happened, whether it was just a single event that produced a virus that had all these symptoms and began to spread as rapidly as it did. We simply don't know what the deal is. The closest piece of evidence we have about this is something which is tantalizing, of a woman in Cameroon in West Africa who had a virus which is a hybrid between one of the chimpanzee viruses and HIV. A virus which arose apparently as a recombination between the chimpanzee virus and HIV-1. We don't know what happened to that woman. She disappeared, and nobody knows whether she died of the effects. Nobody knows. But all you have is that, you know, that one blood sample in which you find this virus. So genetic recombination might in fact be playing a big role in making that jump. Maybe two kinds of viruses were involved here, you know, and the rest of HIV-1 came from something else. All kinds of unexpected processes can happen here. In the case of bubonic plague, so far as I know, nobody's come up with a good indication that the bacteria that caused the pneumonic form is much different from the ones that don't. It's a matter of numbers here. You get enough numbers, people begin to breathe clouds of these bacteria at other people, and then you start getting a real runaway process. Well, you know, HIV was tough. It began to spread very, very slowly originally. When it got to the US in the late 1960s, it was really spreading rather slowly. And the people it spread in were people who had many, many homosexual contacts. It's now spreading much more easily, and it's spreading much more easily in other parts of the world. Has it evolved to the point where it can spread much more easily? Are the viruses that have gone through repeated human transfers becoming more virulent with time? If they want to survive, maybe this is the way to go. Maybe, you know, you do want to spread more easily, and I suspect that might have happened. It would be instructive, though rather hard to do the experiment, to take some of the old viruses from people's freezers way back when and ask, would they do as much damage as present-day viruses? You know, do we have these viruses evolved? Almost certainly they have. Although it's striking that pretty much all these viruses all around here can all cause AIDS. It might be, there's been a lot of argument about whether some of them are more virulent than others. I don't think there's any evidence that they are. It looks like they've all become more virulent at the same time. You can rebuild this tree, as Betty Corber and her colleagues have done, and put into the tree viruses from people's freezers that date back all the way to the 1950s. And they all fit in there the way they should. Yeah. So that's a pretty good indication that it's the real thing, you know. You can look back in time using these viruses the way that people are looking back in time using Neanderthal DNA. You know, it's possible to do that. And if you do it, it fits. It's not as if there were... In this case, it looks like it was a single introduction that gave rise to all of HIV-1. And it happened maybe back in the 1930s, she thinks. So anyway, it's a remarkable story, and one that I think illustrates an awful lot of different evolutionary processes. There's a lot to learn about these viruses, and you know, they're very, very dangerous. They're certainly going to end up killing more people than the Black Death ever did. You know, so it's a pretty scary thing that's facing the planet. Now, your nightmare scenario that they can suddenly start to spread more easily is one that, thank goodness, hasn't happened yet, but it could. And in fact, they are spreading more and more easily. Less and less sexual contact is needed to keep these things going, so that you find them beginning to spread in places and parts of the world where most of the transfer now is heterosexual contact. So it's pretty hard to do much about that. Yeah, that's a lot we've covered here. We've gone way over time, but I hope people had a good time. And I'd be glad to... Well, we are going to get lunch, right? Yes, I'd be glad to chat further about these various things.
Before you go,
Yes.
So I want to thank both Gary and Chris again for giving us these broad perspectives. So I think we'll be honest, and also I'd like to...